Selamat datang kembali semuanya. Welcome back to the Inno Techno Podcast, Season 3, Episode 18. I'm Alan Halliwell, venture partner at leading early stage Indonesian VC, AC Ventures, and founder of startup consultancy Gizmo Advisors. While what we might now call traditionally commerce, being the services that global juggernauts such as Amazon have come to deliver to customers in their markets, now seems ubiquitous, it is increasingly clear that Indonesia will deliver entirely new variants of online retail. The most exciting space in my mind would be in the increasingly broad category, which most of us refer to as social commerce. We're extremely pleased to have join us one of the founders of Kitabeli, Pratik Chaturvedi, to discuss the state of progress in social commerce in Indonesia and how we can expect the average Indonesian's e-commerce experience to evolve with time. Thanks so much for joining us today, Pratik.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan. Very excited to be here.
We're very happy to have you on. Now, we actually have some common heritage as former colleagues at Deutsche Bank. How did you end up jumping the tracks of investment banking to land in Startupville?
Deutsche Bank was my first job after college. So I graduated in 2012, went to work at Deutsche Bank. It was a lovely gig and it gave me a lot of time to reflect on what I wanted to do. It also gave me a lot of exposure to a lot of different business models as well to figure out what's working, what's not working, etc. And one of the things that was very clear to me since the time that I was in college was that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I just didn't know what was the idea that I was going to go after. And while working at Deutsche Bank, I happened to stumble upon an idea and just started from there.
Understood. So another very basic question, why Indonesia after a lifetime in India?
Sure. So my first startup, GetFocus, was acquired by an Indonesian company called MocaPos, which was building POS software. This happened back in 2018. And that was the first time that I happened to stumble across Indonesia, came here, saw the tech ecosystem, the startup ecosystem, and fell in love with it. The general adage is that the Indonesian ecosystem is about 5 to 7 years behind India and about 10 to 15 years behind China. I think that overall, it is in line with what I've experienced. And so what I wanted to do was, once you've been an entrepreneur, that bug always bites you and you're always looking for where you can really add value again. And I started looking for opportunities. E-commerce was one that really stood out to me and my co-founding team. So we all met at Mocha and we decided to start this together. We saw that e-commerce was very big in tier one, but practically non-existent in tier two, tier three cities. And we just started from there, looking at different business models, what could work, what might not work, experimenting a lot. And that sort of evolved into what Kitabeli is today.
Understood. Well, you've preempted a bit of my next question, which I note that the founding team is refreshingly both international and co-ed. Can you tell us about how Kitabeli came together? I know you mentioned MocaPos, but can you share a little more color as to how you all converged around this idea and built the team in the early days?
Sure, absolutely. So Kitabeli is co-founded by four of us. So there's myself, Ivana, who is Indonesian, and she's the co-ed part of the team that I guess you were referring to. And then we have Subhash Bishnoi and Gopal Singh Rathore, who are from India, who are our tech co-founders. Ivana and I were both in Indonesia. We were both at MocaPos. We used to work together on a bunch of different projects and we realized that there's a very complementary fit in our skill sets, which is basically I'm more on the strategic product fundraising and business development kind of side, while she is more operations minded. She is much more on ground, gets her hand dirty, etc. And we realized this over a bunch of projects that we worked together that happened to do very well. Subhash worked with me at my first startup called GetFocus. And we've been together for almost, I would say, about 7 or 8 years now in different roles. And Gopal, Subhash, they have been friends since childhood. When we started, we realized that we all had kind of complementary skill sets. And we started just exploring if there was something that we might like to do together. The idea of tier two, tier three social commerce really appealed to all of us. And that was where we started.
Understood. So with no offense intended toward yourselves or any industry participant, the term social commerce has indeed seen such a massive expansion in application, really along the lines of other industry jargon such as super app or AI. What exactly does social commerce mean to you guys?
I do not take offense on that at all. Actually, this is one of the core things that is my job. Every time that we've been out there fundraising, we've been explaining the differences between the different social commerce models. And like you rightly said, the super app and AI were slightly, I would say, overused or even abused terms in the past that a lot of companies use to fundraise. Even if they may have just 5,000 lines of code that could be worked on in Excel, they would still call themselves an AI startup. So similarly, what's happened is that social commerce was hot and hence everyone just wanted to call themselves social commerce. We believe that we are one of the few OG social commerce participants in Indonesia. The reason being that number one, we are direct to consumer. Number two, we focus a lot on referrals, virality, on utilizing our users and our partners' offline networks to grow and to keep our costs down as well. One of the companies that I would say is probably the progeny of social commerce as a concept is Pinduoduo, and we are the ones who are closest to it since we are actually the only ones who are direct to consumer. Everyone else is along the lines of a B2B startup or someone who is helping, let's say, for example, Warungs buy better and cheaper, which is, it is e-commerce. It's just not social.
Understood. So you just referenced Pinduoduo. Maybe we can place this description that you just shared with us into more of a comparative context. For instance, for a listener who might have a better grasp of the Indian or Chinese variants of social commerce, can you do a comparison and contrast of what we're doing at Kitabali relative to these other market paradigms?
Sure, absolutely. So in social commerce, there are three or four basic models that come up everywhere. One is the Pinduoduo model, which says that, hey, I am a direct-to-consumer application. The user buys for themselves directly from me. And there are a lot of bells and whistles that I create along the user flow to make sure that he refers his friends or he gets some sort of network effect going for me. So that's Pinduoduo, direct-to-consumer. Another one is the FRXS model, which is more commonly called community group buying. In that, what would happen is that there would be one community leader who would be responsible for collecting orders from a large group of people. Now that this community leader could be a mom and pop shop owner, it could be someone who is slightly more famous in the neighborhood. And what they would do is that they would go around their neighborhood and say, okay, do you want to buy apples, for example? They would collect orders from, let's say, 50 users and buy 50 kgs of apples. In this case, the order would be placed by the community leader onto the application. And the end user may or may not know what application these apples are coming from. So the loyalty of the app or the long-term brand recall of the app is only with the community leader, not really with the end consumer. The third type is, in India, we have Meesho, the earlier versions of Meesho, and in China, we have the early versions of Yunji, where what they do is that they say that, hey, instead of me getting into all of this stuff, I will basically create a platform where if someone wants to buy an apple, they can buy an apple and they can resell it to someone else at a larger price to make their own margins. This piggybacks, once again, on the network that the community leader has already built. In this case, the flow would look something like this, that the community leader would go to, for example, Alan and say, hey, Alan, would you like to buy apples? Alan would say, yes. What's the price? The community leader would look at the app and on the app, it would show, for example, 150 rupees for 1 kg of apples. And then he would go to Alan and say, okay, I'll sell it to you for 200. And the reseller would pocket the difference. So these are the three main models. And the fourth one is live commerce, which is like Little Red Book, etc., which is a completely different model. So these are the four main models that exist in social commerce in some way, form or the other. And at Kitabli, what we've done is we've taken the good parts of Pinduoduo, which is the direct-to-consumer approach. At the same time, we've taken the good part of community group buying, which is piggybacking on the relationships that have already been built by the community leaders who are, like, for example, very famous in their neighborhood, and combined these two to make a model that is very uniquely Indonesian and that works very well for Indonesia.
That was far and away the most concise and comprehensible description of the basic types of social commerce. So thanks for that primer. I wanted to tighten the focus even more around Indonesia. Can you tell us a bit more about how Indonesian social commerce is truly evolving uniquely relative to, for instance, the Chinese and Indian precedent? Does, for instance, the Indonesian consumer behave at all differently from his or her Asian neighbors?
Yes. So there are some things that make Indonesia very similar to China and India, and some things that make it a very unique place to be. So, for example, let's go into the differences first. In terms of differences, one very large difference between China and Indonesia is the purchasing power. China is way, way, way richer, even in a tier 2, tier 3 city. A tier 2 city in China has 10 million people. A tier 2 city in Indonesia has maybe 2 or 3 million. So that leads to a very large difference in the kind of density that you expect, in the kind of money that you expect these users to spend, and in the kind of items that they expect to buy. Second is, I would say that Indonesia is slightly more trusting than India, but slightly less trusting than China. And that leads to a situation where you have to bridge that trust gap as fast as you can to be able to grow as fast as you need to. And finally, one more difference is that, for example, China, the density itself of people is much higher, right? Even in a city with, let's say, 4 million or 5 million people, there would be massive apartment complexes. There would be hypermarkets. There would be a very well laid out e-commerce infrastructure for delivery. These things don't exist in Indonesia. And hence, the way that you build things has to be very different. So that's, I would say, the challenges that make things very unique to Indonesia. That's what we as founders end up grappling with about, I would say, 60 to 70% of the time on a daily basis to figure out, how do we solve these problems that no one else has solved in the world before? And that's what makes this entire journey a lot of fun. For me personally, I love puzzles. I love puzzle solving. And these are massive puzzles to be solved at a grand scale, which makes me very happy.
Again, so we have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson doing online masterclasses about the cosmos. You absolutely should consider a side hustle doing a masterclass on social commerce. This has all been very enlightening. Now, focusing on Kitabeli, we have largely skirted tier one markets such as Jakarta. How do tier two and three cities behave differently than the top tier urban markets on a social commerce basis?
So there are three major differences. The first piece is trust. The tier one users have been exposed to the internet for more than a decade now. They have bought stuff online and they've interacted with platforms like Tokopedia, Shopee, Lazada, Gojek since 2010. It's very easy for them to trust. It's very easy for them to get accommodated, to get accustomed to buying something online. That trust does not exist in tier two cities. For example, the first time that I went to Malang, which is now one of our largest cities, I remember I was sitting on the road and I was trying to get people to buy stuff online, not from Kitabeli, from anywhere. And I would ask them that, hey, have you heard of these e-commerce websites? And they would either say, yes, I've heard of it, or they would say, no, I've never heard of it. For the guys who had heard of it, we would ask them, why haven't you bought anything online? And their reasons were like, oh, what if I get a fake item? What if there's a problem with the item? What if the company runs away with my money? These are problems that we faced in India back in 2010. And these are the same problems that I faced when talking to users in 2018-19 in tier 2, tier 3 Indonesia. So that trust gap is massive. The second is logistics and delivery. Very interestingly, tier 1 has evolved to be an extremely lovely place for e-commerce because most of your suppliers are in the tier 1 city. Most of your buyers are in the tier 1 city. Hence, most of the linkages that need to be made between them are tier 1 to tier 1. And one of the differences that I would say that a lot of people outside Indonesia don't know is that Tokopedia, Shopee, etc. are not the Amazon of Indonesia. They are the eBay of Indonesia, which is a very different kind of model. They both say that, hey, look, millions of buyers, here are your hundreds of thousands of sellers, go talk to each other, I will stay out of, which is very different from Amazon. Amazon says, hey, I'm going to control each and every step in the process. So that leads to a very different way that these markets evolve, which is why in tier one Indonesia, it is very easy to get stuff delivered same day, next day, 5 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 10 minutes also. These things don't exist in tier two cities. So even today, if you were to go to Malang or Solo and try to buy something online from one of the large e-commerce players, it will be shipped from a tier one city, which means that it will take 3 to 7 days to deliver. It will take $1 to $3 as delivery fee, which maybe the e-commerce company will offset it out, but eventually someone has to pay for it. Hence, the old models don't work. And finally, the last piece is the UX itself. Since tier one users are more accepting of the internet and they're okay with complicated UX flows, etc., what you have is these large bulky apps, which are like hundreds of MB. And when you open the app, there's a spin the wheel and a slot machine and a go water this plant and 50 other things that are happening. And tier one users are okay with it. Tier two users get confused. When I opened these apps on my phone in Malang and I gave it to a user on the street, I said, hey, just buy anything, I'll pay for it. After fiddling around for 2-3 minutes, he was like, dude, I cannot. I have no idea what to do. So the user experience needs to be very different as well. What we've done is we've taken each of these problems and we've solved them separately. So for example, trust, for solving the trust problem, we have a very large network of community leaders who are nano influencers in their small block, who have a lot of sway over the 50 to 100 houses in their neighborhood. They are the ones who go around telling people, hey, you should buy from Kitabli. For logistics and delivery, we open our own warehouse in every city, which allows us to do same day, next day, and 2 day delivery at very low cost. And in terms of the app itself, our app is 95% smaller in terms of size than any of the leading applications out there. So this is what helps us grow in otherwise very competitive environment.
Excellent. Super clear. Now, once again, you've addressed some of my next planned question with your comments just now, but let's spend a little more time on this. How does Kitabli accomplish its logistics? Do we work exclusively with 3PLs or third-party logistics companies? Or do we do everything from holding inventory to last-mile delivery in-house? I've read that we have, for instance, our own distribution network. Can you give us a little more color around logistics?
Sure, absolutely. So what we realized when we started doing this entire piece was that having a one-to-one model of delivery is going to be extremely expensive. By one-to-one, what I mean is that, let's say, for example, Alan orders something and then I have one guy on a bike taking this order and delivering it to Alan. That is going to be very expensive. The next step in this evolution is that, okay, instead of having one guy take one order from my warehouse and deliver to only Alan, I will have him take 20 orders and then do a milk run of sorts. That is what most other guys do. We have taken this one step further. So what we do is, let's go back to the community leader, this nano influencer who has been able to convince, let's say, 20 houses in her neighborhood to download the app and start buying from there. So what would happen is that, let's say on Monday, out of those 20, maybe 4 or 5 users will place an order. All of these orders will get bulked up at our warehouse. And instead of our delivery boy going and delivering 5 different orders to 5 different people, our delivery boy goes and delivers all of these 5 orders in one shot to the community leader, who then does the last mile delivery to all the 5 users. This allows us to scale up our logistics very quickly and keep our logistics cost very low. And what generally ends up happening with us is that a lot of 3PLs reach out to us saying that they would like to work with us. We found that generally we are a lot more cost competitive than them at this stage.
Thanks for that. So in this model, how do we think about CapEx, or basically investment in equipment and hard assets, and OpEx, or operating expenditures, the expenses that arise every day in fulfilling our business goals, in having our own distribution? Are things like demand density, for instance, you enter a new community, is there enough demand to justify this investment? Are things like demand density important to establish before we roll out distribution to a new community?
So let's take one step back and see what's the user's problem. The user's problem is that they need stuff delivered to them within one day. Otherwise, it's too slow. From that point of view, is having a warehouse the best solution? They need stuff cheap and they need it delivered fast. So from that point of view, a 1P model like ours, where we have our own warehouse, where we stock our own items, makes a lot of sense compared to more of a free-ranging marketplace where anyone can come and list their items. So that becomes one big change one big reason that is pro having our own warehouses. I know that a lot of other startups and a lot of other investors, they prefer asset-light models, but unfortunately, this is what the user wants, and this is the only way to serve them. So if we are going down that path, what do we need? We need to make sure, you're absolutely right, demand density is something that is extremely important. Getting very low days of inventory is very important. There are a lot of these crucial parts that move around in our model that we have to make sure that work, right? What works for us is that once we are able to get, let's say, two or three transacting users in a neighborhood, through our products, virality features and referral features, they end up inviting a lot more friends in their neighborhood, which then gives us that density quite quickly, which means that we don't have to spend too much of our own marketing efforts trying to target that community. All we have to do is we have to make sure that a good community leader is onboarded who can onboard a significant number of people. And then we have to make sure that those people are then incentivized and are able to onboard a lot of their friends via the virality and referral features of the app. That is what allows this model to work.
Understood. Now, you've mentioned on a number of occasions that our beachhead within a new large market involves a warehouse where we hold product purchased directly from the big brands. How do we manage what we call inventory risk, whereby we buy or invest in product that for some reason or other we cannot sell, and thus we quote unquote eat that cost? How do we think about that type of inventory risk?
Yeah, to be very honest with you, it's been a painful learning that we've learned how to manage these problems. The good thing for us, this is where we are incredibly lucky, is we've been able to attract some top-level talent to join us and help build out these things. So for example, our senior leaders in product, tech, ops, finance, everyone is from a very large startup or a very large company. And they've faced all these problems before. They know what are the issues that we will face, and they know how to line up their ducks to make sure that one shot fixes a lot of problems. In the past, we've had a lot of these issues, to be very upfront and honest with you. But now, as we grow with scale, as the data that we collect becomes so much better, as we know what customers want to buy and what they don't want to buy, we are able to monitor these things very effectively and make sure that we are hitting the right metrics across the board. And one more thing that actually works in our favor on this is that we started off with daily essentials and FMCG items, because our hypothesis was that if we go after items that people buy very frequently, then buying from Kitabli will become the habit, which then means that in the long term, we'll be able to sell other higher margin goods and products as well, even if they're lower frequency. And that has worked out very well for us. That's one thing that we've been able to optimize very well on our side.
Understood. Now, knock on wood, we hopefully have seen the worst of the pandemic and how it has altered life in Indonesia. It, for instance, clearly accelerated online penetration of retail. What did it do for Kitabli, which by virtue of when it was founded, I guess, is itself a COVID baby?
Yeah. So to be very honest with you, because we started out just at the time COVID had hit, that was when we had started. So our first day of office was the first day that COVID was announced in Indonesia. So we actually don't know what life would have been like for us before COVID. What we've seen again and again is that users always want things delivered to them cheaply, and they want to buy stuff cheap, which is why we see that in every geography, it's always the discounter who is the biggest retailer. For example, Walmart, Aldi or DMart in India, these are the big retailers. Now, if you're going after this market, which is, of course, the largest market to go after, then COVID or no COVID does not matter. As long as we are able to give a good experience to our customers, as long as we are able to give a good price to our customers, they will always stick with us.
Understood. Now, Pratik, are we seeing any backpedaling in those behaviors that COVID triggered now that lockdowns are more scarce and social distancing is not as restrictive?
Not for us. We've still seen our order volumes grow. We've still seen users buying very frequently from us, still referring and sharing with their friends and getting a lot of virality going. We've in fact seen users start buying more and more categories as well, which has helped us improve our general mix across that app as well. So we've not seen much of that backpedaling. I think that given that the kind of space that we operate in is very specific, which is tier two, tier three, daily essentials till now, and now going into other categories like beauty, personal care, etc. We've not seen any of that backpedaling happen.
That's encouraging. Now, what other platforms are our customers using currently? And what is the scope for an increase in the competition that we face?
So I think that as we tend to prove out the market, I think we will attract bigger and better competition. And I think that's good for the market as a whole. It helps grow the market. It helps push us to perform better. And we actually warmly encourage others to get into the space as well, because it will push us to be a lot better and make sure that we are providing the best experience possible to our customers. And at this moment, we've seen that there is not much, frankly speaking, in terms of what the other players are able to provide that we cannot. In fact, for our location base, for our geographical base, our services are way better than any of the other applications as well. So we have a pretty good head start out there, and we have a very good model that works. I think that some of the things that we have figured out are things that other companies have tried many times, but have not been able to figure out. For example, virality, referrals, the whole community leader model. These are things that we've experimented on over the past 2 years very intensely to find out what works, what doesn't work. And that's, I would say, our USP that helps us to grow and build a different kind of business than anyone else.
I did want to pursue this line of discussion a bit further, maybe looking longer term, because I know the generic e-commerce platforms from Shopee to Tokopedia to Lazada and others, they all seem to have plans to expand their offerings within FMCG or fast-moving consumer goods. Are we braced for intensifying competition from these types?
Absolutely. I think that the biggest difference between FMCG and the other categories that the others generally go after is the margins. FMCG is historically lower margin than, let's say, fashion, beauty, etc., which then means that your entire cost structure, your entire supply chain, your CAC models, everything have to be super, super tight. Otherwise, you cannot grow this in a good unit economics positive manner. And that is one of the things that we have focused on. That is one of the things that has helped us get to where we are today. Going forward, we are going into other higher margin categories such as beauty, personal care, snacks and beverages, and a bunch of others. And we will end up competing with them. But our USP to our users will always be that, look, we will give you this stuff faster than anyone else can in a tier two, tier three city. We will give you this stuff at a much better price because of the way that we are structured as a 1P model rather than as a marketplace, which allows us then to build faster and build better as well.
Gotcha. Going back to a very basic question, which maybe I should have asked earlier in our discussion, what exactly is our business model? In other words, how do we generate revenues currently?
So our business model is very straightforward. We go to brands and principals and we buy from them. We store these items in our warehouse. We get a bunch of these community leaders and users to share their purchases and to buy themselves. And we then ship these items from our warehouse to the end user. So for us, the flow of cash is very straightforward. We would buy from the brand or the principal at, let's say, 90. We would sell it to the user at, let's say, 100. And in that 100 minus 90, which is 10, I have to cover my CAC, I have to cover my logistics cost. It's one of the easiest, simplest models ever, because this is probably one of the oldest or second oldest businesses to have existed, which is that I buy at X, I sell at X plus delta.
Got you. Very clear. Now, I assume that this business model matures and becomes more profitable over the next 2 to 3 years. If so, what would support that evolution toward profitability?
Sure. Number one is that as we go deeper and deeper into a city, by deeper, I mean, as we get more and more users to buy from us, it allows our logistics to be way more efficient, which then reduces the logistics cost per order, which allows us to be way more efficient as well. Second is that once the city starts growing, there's a certain tipping point beyond which users start coming in automatically, and that keeps our CAC extremely low. The third is that over time, they start off with FMCG. And as they get used to buying from us, they start going into other categories such as beauty, personal care, home and living, buying bed sheets and socks and whatnot from us. So in the path to profitability, number one is to keep logistics costs very low. Number two is keep marketing costs very low. And number three is push the sales of high margin goods as well, which on all these three things, we have a very clear path and we know exactly what to do there.
Great. Now, Prateek, another basic question. What are our biggest categories and how do we think about category expansion going forward? I know you mentioned a couple that you're layering in right now, but where do we go in terms of the categories that we sell over the next few years?
So our target audience is moms, housewives, homemakers in tier 2, tier 3 cities. Our top selling categories are things that mom or a housewife would use at least once a day and buy at least once or twice a week. So that leads to this entire gamut of daily staples such as rice, cooking oil, etc. that we focus on very heavily. Now, going forward, we are going into categories that are slightly ancillary. I would say slightly parallel to these, but can serve a very similar audience base. Beauty is one that's growing very well for us. Home and living is growing very well for us as well. Mom and baby is massive, and personal care as well. Our end goal is that we want to make sure that we have at least 50% wallet share for all the things that a mom or a housewife would buy at least once a month. That's the end goal for us.
Prateek, is Kitabeli's model for Indonesia at all portable to other surrounding markets?
100%. This is one thing that we've seen. After we started Kitabeli, we've seen a bunch of other companies, other startups spring up in the surrounding countries as well. A couple of them have made it really big in India as well. So the core of the model is that if you have a community of people who like to share information with each other, who like to share things like, hey, look, I saved money by buying from this app. If they like to do that, then our model will work. And across the globe in tier 2, tier 3 cities, this is what we've seen again and again. So we are 100% confident that this model will scale everywhere that we can get to as fast as we can.
Now, our e-commerce model is clearly already quite articulated and very robust. Do we have a game plan for ancillary financial services?
So at this point, the very promising thing for us is that for a lot of our users, this is the first time that they're buying something online, or this is the first time that they're interacting with an online service where money exchange is required, which is great, which means that then that opens up the entire gamut of financial services, whether it be like starter things like wallets, all the way up to loans, all the way up to buy now, pay later. It opens up everything to us. The way that we see it is that this is the time that we need to be extremely focused on what we do and make sure that we are able to crack it really well. And the ancillary services are things that we can always get into at a later stage. But yes, that is a very promising opportunity for us. And that keeps us, again, very excited and very happy while we are working on these things.
Great to hear. Again, Prateek, I'm sure you've heard this before. You clearly have an alternative career as a professor or a public speaker awaiting you. Should you seek a side hustle? Truly, you have singularly advanced my understanding of social commerce, both in its generic forms and as it begins to mold itself to the unique contours of the Indonesian experience. Really exciting also to imagine how social commerce in tiers 2 and below in Indonesia evolved behind Kitabeli's innovations. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Alan. This has been a lot of fun and hope to see you again.
Great to hear. We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's episode. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indo Techno podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.